Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, California's water system supplies 23 million residents and millions of acres of farmland with water, but most of it comes through the fragile ecosystem that is the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. We'll hear a special report on Valley Water and talk to Assemblymember Henry T. Perea about the future of the state's water bond and the controversial Bay Delta Conservation Plan. We'll also talk about the state's ongoing corrections problem and go inside the SHU at Corcoran State Prison. And later in the show, would you let your kids play football? That's a question many parents are asking in the aftermath of a new PBS documentary on football-related brain injuries. We'll talk to a local expert and a former player who's still dealing with the consequences of the game. That and more on Valley Edition, but first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. It's often said that California Governor Jerry Brown likes to find his way to the political center by paddling a little to the left and a little to the right. Democratic Assemblyman Ken Cooley says you could see the governor's political philosophy at work in his bill signings and vetoes in recent days.
It is a time of intense political polarization, as we see in Washington, D.C., where they grind to a halt. I think he's trying not to go down the polarization page. He's trying not to just be so predictable that, you know, he is aiding and abetting the gridlock.
Two subjects in particular appeared to show Brown paddling toward the center. The governor signed about two-thirds of the gun control bills to reach his desk, as well as a measure that will prohibit the use of lead ammunition in hunting. But he vetoed several more, including a ban on semi-automatic rifles with detachable magazines. Brown also rejected several union-backed bills this past weekend, yet he signed some of the labor's top priorities this year, too, such as minimum wage increase and overtime pay for domestic workers. A new analysis of Californians and their health care suggests quality is improving in some areas. But as Pauline Bartolone reports from Sacramento, California is behind the nation by other measures.
The report from the California Healthcare Foundation found the state stood out from the national average in emergency room wait times. Californians admitted to the hospital from the ER typically waited over 5 hours, almost an hour longer than the national average.
I'm not surprised because we've known that it's a very large problem in parts of California.
Howard Backer is director of the Emergency Medical Services Authority of California.
This is a process measure that impacts many other aspects of healthcare quality and patient care.
But there was positive data in the report. It suggests Californians getting long-term nursing home care were the least likely in the nation to have lost too much weight, be depressed, or have a fall with a major injury. California adults are also slightly less likely to have chronic conditions such as high blood pressure, obesity, and arthritis. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
California environmentalists say they saw very few victories in the 2013 legislative session. They say battles in Sacramento amounted to defense against assaults rather than significant accomplishments. Of the 10 bills to regulate the oil extraction process known as fracking, only one became law, and support of that bill was split among environmental groups. A bill that would have allowed the Coastal Commission to levy fines failed, as did four other safe drinking water bills. Bruce Resnick is with the Planning and Conservation League.
There was a whole host of bills, I mean, dozens of good environmental bills that made it through. Just nothing that was major. You know, none of the big things that we're looking at.
Resnick says they were successful in staving off big changes to the California Environmental Quality Act, and a bill that bans lead ammunition became law. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Throughout 2013, prisons have been in the news in California. Earlier today, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Governor Jerry Brown's final legal maneuver to avoid shedding nearly 10,000 more inmates from California's overcrowded prisons. The issue of prisons goes beyond that, though. This summer, thousands of prisoners in California went on a hunger strike to protest the controversial security housing units. Inmates say the isolated conditions in the SHU are intolerable. The strike, in part, prompted the legislature to hold hearings last week to look at solitary confinement. But prison officials say the harsh punishment is necessary to deal with the worst of the worst. KPCC's Rena Palta recently visited the SHU at Corcoran State Prison in the Central Valley and brings us this report.
The SHU yard is lined with 6-by-10-foot cages where inmates are pacing, doing push-ups, or just chatting with others in neighboring cages. SHU inmates get at least 10 hours a week in these outdoor spaces. The rest of the time, they're generally inside their cells, which are fairly typical, with radios, beds, and a small window to the yard. Edward Frias is a solid, muscular guy who says he lost 20 pounds during a hunger strike over the summer protesting SHU conditions.
I was found guilty of second-degree murder. I was defending myself, and unfortunately, somebody died.
Some inmates are here on specific sentences because they committed crimes in prison, like attacking correctional officers. Frias says he ended up in the SHU 8 years ago because another inmate told prison officials he was involved with the higher-ups in a prison gang.
Pretty much hearsay.
He can be kept here indefinitely as long as prison officials determine he's engaged in gang behavior.
To be in solitude that long and away from your family again and be confined. Look where I'm at. I go from one cage to another, you know? I feel like a dog. And it's hard. So, yes.
Did it change you at all?
Yes, it did. It made me a little bit harder. You know, I'm not as optimistic about things as I used to be. But I still have my hope and I have my faith. So.
Frias, like other hunger strikers, wants a complete end to the use of shoes in California. Warden Connie Gibson says that's not going to happen. She says there are some inmates who are committing crimes in prison or trafficking drugs for a gang or making weapons that could maim or kill fellow inmates. Gibson says those inmates make the prison a dangerous place and she needs a way to deal with them.
Just like if you have a barrel of apples and you got one apple that's going spoiled, you've got to remove it out or everybody spoils. In this case, you can't have inmates who want to be disruptive. That's their whole agenda. To continue to be disruptive in an open forum where other inmates aren't afforded the opportunity to program.
Some SHU inmates have been linked to gang activity outside prison as well, calling hits on rival gangs or making drug deals from behind bars. Recently, a SHU inmate in Pelican Bay State Prison, who helped lead the hunger strike this summer, was accused by Los Angeles federal prosecutors of helping orchestrate a drug trafficking ring in Southern California.
They're controlling a lot of the street criminal activity out here.
Gibson says removing gang leaders from the general inmate population and into the SHU is their way of combating the prison's gang problem. Frias downplays the gang problem and says, anyway, he doesn't think it makes the conditions in the SHU fair.
In a whole, we are going through a very stressful situation, and it does drive people crazy.
Officials have promised reforms and are already implementing changes in the SHUs. They're looking at the records and behavior logs of every SHU inmate to see if he or she can be moved to the general population. Frias expects to have a hearing soon. So far, about 70 accused gang members from Corcoran SHU have been released to the general population under the new review process. About 645 remain. Rena Palta, 89.3 KPCC.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. California is the nation's largest agricultural state. Its farms and ranches generated nearly $45 billion in revenue last year. That wouldn't be possible without water exported from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to once what was an arid valley. Farmers say the water is their lifeblood, but it's been cut back year after year. In the third of our multi-part series, California's Delta, Inside and Out, environment reporter Amy Quinton talks to farmers about their dependence on the Delta.
At Magpie Cafe in Sacramento, the lunch crowd is thinning. Ed Rohr is Magpie's co-owner and chef.
Most food that we use probably comes from California. We had cherries to start, but now we're using black figs. And those all come from the Central Valley. And some days we get 80% of our produce comes from California.
Most of it wouldn't be possible without Delta water and the canals and pipelines that send it south. No one knows that better than Joe Del Bosque. We're in Los Banos, on the western side of the Central Valley. We hop on a packing truck as workers pick cantaloupes from his 120-acre field. Del Bosque remembers what this area looked like before the Federal Central Valley Project brought water to the valley. He points to the dry golden foothills in the distance.
Just grazing land. That's all it was. That would turn green for a few months in the spring and then dry the rest of the year. That's what this was. Without water, that's what this would look like. Just bare ground or short, dry grass.
Now, Del Bosque has 2,200 acres of farmland that he says is some of the most fertile you can find.
I'm blessed to have so many options. If I don't want to grow cantaloupes, I can grow tomatoes, or I can grow asparagus, or I can almonds, or, you know, peppers.
This year, though, he had to leave 300 acres fallow. The Central Valley Project cut water deliveries to 20%. He says he and other farmers thought they were headed into a great year because of an early wet winter.
Well, we weren't able to take advantage of those high flows in the Sacramento River because there happened to be some smelt that were caught in the pumps. And it wasn't just a shutdown of a day or two. It was 60 days.
Farmers have had to adjust over the years as the Endangered Species Act protected the Delta smelt and other threatened fish. The Westlands Water District estimated that 800,000 acre-feet of water was lost when pumping stopped. The dry months that followed made the situation worse.
We're trying to maintain the water that will sustain us. We're not trying to take more. But we've been cut back from 100% to 20%. Or 10% in 2009. We can't be sustained by that.
As you can see, they grow big and tall.
150 miles to the south, Rod Stiefvater walks through drip-irrigated pistachio orchards just outside of Bakersfield. He farms 8,000 acres, mostly in Kern County. He says the economics of water in California means fewer farmers plant lower-valued row crops, such as cotton. Stiefvater says without the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and its proposed tunnels, some crops will go.
More than likely, our allocations will continue to fall. And that will mean more and more drought years for us in terms of having adequate supply of water. And it'll probably mean the lower value crops that are grown here will disappear.
Kern County is the largest agricultural water user of the State Water Project. Agriculture accounts for a third of the county's economy.
Particularly in Kern County, we kind of view ourselves as ground zero, where loss of water will affect our economy, our quality of life.
Kern County Water Agency General Manager Jim Beck says the criticism that Big Ag is taking Delta water is unfair.
I spend a lot of time in Stockton and Sacramento explaining that I'm not out to take your water. We're not trying to benefit our area to the detriment of another area. We're trying to receive the benefits that we believe can be acquired without damaging other areas.
He hopes the BDCP is the solution. He says on average, Kern County receives about 60% of its contracted water. He doubts the BDCP will restore it all, but hopes it will make a difference and says it should be important to the whole state.
Kern County and the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley are one among the most productive agricultural areas in the world, not just California or the United States. We're talking about the world.
Farmers believe that could be at risk without an adequate water supply from the Delta. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
And you can see the rest of Amy's report on our website at kvpr.org. And again, that's a five-part series that continues all throughout this week on Morning Edition here on Valley Public Radio. Joining us now in the studio, we have a special guest, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea from Fresno, someone who's very familiar with these issues of water in the state of California. Assemblymember Perea, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Just yesterday, officials with the state's Department of Water Resources held an event calling attention to the worry about another dry year and what that might mean for the entire state, especially the Central Valley. This is a big concern for folks in your district. The Bay Delta Conservation Plan has been going on for years now, and we're finally starting to see it coalesce, but there's still a lot of concern about what it actually means. Where do you see the current state of the plan, and how does it work for the Valley?
Well, I think the BDCP is still very controversial and very divisive, mostly between the North Valley and the South Valley, where we live here in Fresno. But I do think that it's important to note that the preservation and the enhancement of the Delta is important for all of our economies and for all of our communities to thrive. It's not just important for the communities that are in the Delta, but it's important for those of us who rely on Delta water here in Fresno in the South Valley, but as well as Southern California, who also rely heavily on the Delta, and ensuring that the Delta is healthy and sustainable is important for all of us. So I think that while it's still controversial and the governor, is, as part of BDCP, is proposing his twin tunnels, which is hugely controversial up and down the entire state, I do think it really points to the broader picture. And that is that we have to make smart infrastructure investments to make sure that we have that we allow to move the water that we currently have in a way that's most efficient.
What are you hearing from farmers in this part of the state right now, and their concerns about the future going forward just with what we have right now? We're all hoping for a wet year, but we don't know yet.
Well, I mean, I think nobody's optimistic. And everybody is extremely concerned. I mean, just listening to your report and talking with Farmer Joe Del Bosque, who I think really did a very good job in describing what's really happening out on the, especially out on the west side of Fresno County, because of the lack of water. But even if we did have a good year, we still have capacity issues where we don't have the amount of storage that we need to capture the water that we could use in dry years, like what we think is going to be this year. So we still have infrastructure issues that we have to address, whether it's above and below ground storage, conveyance, that could be the tunnels, that could be just restoring the Delta so that more water can flow through the Delta. I mean, there are a number of ways at looking at trying to produce and enhance the amount of water that we have in our valley, but all options have to be on the table, and I think they are. We're just trying to put together the right political coalition to get it done.
And that's a big concern. There's a talk of this $25 billion tunnel plan. There's a lot of concern about the cost there. There's a lot of concern about also the environmental costs. There are folks who are concerned about the health of the Delta, and they say taking any more water out of the Delta is going to be detrimental to that ecosystem. They say there's no way that you can conserve the Delta by taking more water out. When it comes to cost, though, regardless of the environmental issue, this is going to be a very expensive project. And there's some people raising questions about whether water users, whether they're in Southern California or Valley farmers, are going to want to pay the cost of this type of system. What's the breaking point there? Where do you see that going?
Well, I think it is important to note, as you just mentioned, that the cost of this project is going to be borne by the user. So the taxpayers are not going to be on the hook for this. It's going to be those that will benefit from the flow of the water will be on the hook for paying for the project. Where that breaking point is, I think it's different for every agency. Every agency that will see a benefit from the project will have to make a determination what is their breaking point? What is their price point that they're willing to pay for the water? Right now, we just don't know that yet. I think everybody's trying to get to a place because they need – get to a place where they can say yes because they need the water and the reliability so desperately. But these water districts that will be paying the bill, of course, are going to have to go back to their members, which are farmers. In the case of Metropolitan Water District in Los Angeles, it's consumers. And will they be able to sustain an increase in their rates in order to pay for the reliability? I don't have the answer to that. I do think that most are trying to figure out a way to say yes.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Assemblymember Henry T. Perea of Fresno about California's water situation. The issue is often framed as farmers versus environmentalists. That's what we often hear in the valley. You drive up and down Highway 99 or Interstate 5 or 41, and you see these trailers, and they attack certain members for not being for the farmers. But it's really a lot more complex than that, because you have farmers in the northern part of the valley, north of the Delta, in the Delta, that are on opposite sides of the issue from the farmers in Fresno County, Kings County, Kern County. There's a lot of different interests. How do you go about trying to build a coalition in trying to get whatever, whether it's a $5 billion plan or a $25 billion mm-hmm. plan through? How do you go about building that coalition when even interests that, to the layperson, you would think, well, all farmers are going to be for more water.
Right.
It's a lot more complex than that. How do you build that coalition?
It's much more complex than that. And I think we have to start in any time you're looking to build a coalition, everybody has to get something out of it. And we can't let, as we move through the process of building a coalition, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, meaning that every member, every stakeholder of the coalition is going to have to know coming into a negotiation that they're not going to get everything that they want, but that they have to see the big picture and why it's important to make sure that water is flowing efficiently and effectively across our state for all of our economies. Because it's not just, as you mentioned, environmentalists opposed to agricultural interests, but it's farmers in the North Delta who are fighting farmers in Fresno. It's the fishermen that are fighting both the environmentalists and the farmers. You have big metropolitan communities like Los Angeles who need to see a fix in the Delta that are now entering the fray in a much larger way than we've ever seen before. We have interests in the northern part of the state who don't want anything to be done, because in their mind, it can only be bad, because most of the water is in Northern California, and they see this as the southern part of the state stealing their water. So this is less about the valley and more about the Northern California versus Los Angeles constituency. So the issue becomes, can't we bring the right mix of stakeholders together who won't let the perfect be the enemy of the good and will allow for some sort of compromise and negotiation to occur. And we're going to get our first crack at that when we start renegotiating the water bond this year.
And that's what I want to go to next. Voters may soon have a chance to weigh in on this. A few years ago, when Governor Schwarzenegger originally proposed the water bond, it was an $11.1 billion measure that has changed in many forms over the years. Right before the legislature adjourned for the year, it was raised. It was cut. It was raised. It's now set $6.5 billion. There's a lot of horse trading going on and things in this process. Can you bring us up to date on where it stands right now and where you stand on the water bond?
Sure. So I'm very supportive of the water bond. And if the legislature does nothing in renegotiating the water bond, there will be a bond for the voters to vote on this coming election in November. Now, all the public polls point that to the fact that this bond doesn't pass. And so that's why we're trying to renegotiate what that looks like. So we're trying to get under $10 billion. The current bond is just a little over 11. We're trying to get under 10 and try to cut some of the maybe less, some of the projects that are not as closely related to water, and really just stay focused to really the core mission of what a water bond should be. And in my mind, it should really address three things. It should address the sustainability in the Delta. It should provide infrastructure projects so we can store and move water along. And we need to invest more in clean drinking water projects, not just for the valley, but up and down the entire state to deal with issues like high levels of nitrates and arsenic and other issues, other contaminants that are poisoning our waters up and down the state. So I see those as the three key pieces of the bond. Now, can we do all that with $6, $8, $9 billion? It's going to be very difficult. But the beginning of the year, I do currently sit on the speaker's working group for reworking the water bond, and so we, as members of the legislature, are meeting with stakeholders, and we're trying to find those sweet spots with the various stakeholders to try to find a bond that will be less. That will hopefully earn voter support next November.
You mentioned cleaning up drinking water for residents in rural communities in the Valley. That's been a big issue for years here. And in the last year, you've drafted some legislation that was recently signed by the governor on that issue. There have been some bottlenecks in Sacramento for years that have prevented some of these communities from cleaning up the nitrate pollution, cleaning up some wells that are really bad and people who otherwise don't have clean drinking water. Have we cleared those bottlenecks now with some of this recent legislation? Where do we stand with that?
Sure. So the answer is yes and no. Yes, in that we had some bills signed by the governor this year that have cleaned up some of the bureaucratic roadblocks that have prevented many of our disadvantaged communities from accessing money to clean their drinking water. But the big issue, really, and one of the bills that I was unable to get through this year was a bill that would have moved the responsibility of the Clean Drinking Water Program from the Department of Public Health to the State Water Board. And the whole point of doing that is because the State Water Board has a very good track record in moving money from the state to disadvantaged communities to get the projects needed so they can have clean drinking water. DPH, on the other hand, does not have the same record. In fact, the US EPA sent them a letter telling them that their $455 million was in jeopardy because of their inability to administer the funds to get out to these small communities. And so we attempted to make that move this year. We were unsuccessful, although I will say that recent word is that the governor's office is still going to look at making that move and that it may in fact happen during next year's budget.
Very interesting. Moving on to some other issues, we heard the report on prisons just a few moments ago and the news that the U.S. Supreme Court today rejected Governor Brown's request for an appeal on the effort to move the deadline for reducing the number of prisoners in the state's overcrowded prisons. Where do you stand on the issue of trying to sort this out? The governor has his plan for trying to house some of these inmates. He doesn't want to release any more inmates than have already been released and is looking at private prisons and other things to try to solve this issue. Some people say our prison population is much too large and our prisons simply aren't working. They aren't reducing recidivism at all. We need to look at other sorts of strategies beyond this locking people up. Where do you stand on trying to sort this out? Because it's pretty clear the courts are not backing down from their belief that the conditions right now are intolerable and unconstitutional.
So I voted to support the governor's plan, and I think the governor's plan is a short-term solution to ensure that thousands of prisoners are not released out into our streets. And so I support the plan, and I believe it was the right thing to do. Now, it does buy us some time to really think about the big picture and where do we go from here. Like, I'm a big believer in balance. I believe in finding the right balance in keeping people locked up for committing the crimes that they do, especially those that create heinous crimes. But we have to provide a pathway for people to be rehabilitated. And that means making real investments. And so I think we're going to have to make two investments. The investments to keep people locked up, and if that means building more prisons or if that means enhancing the current conditions that we have to keep people in, I support that. But I also believe that for those individuals that want to do something with their lives, that want the opportunity to make amends, we should provide every opportunity in order for them to do that. And that means investing in education, investing in vocational education, investing in the right programs, drug counselings within our prison system so that people have the resources they need to get their lives back on track. I'm a firm believer in redemption. And I believe that taking both tracks is where we need to go. But the gut check for the legislature and the governor is going to be, do we want to pay for it? And we'll find out when the budget comes next year.
We have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about a couple of bills that you authored that the governor recently signed. This workers' compensation bill with professional athletes is kind of interesting, and this issue, I think, is something that was kind of under the radar for most people. You had athletes from out of state that were filing claims in California. Your bill has addressed that. The governor signed it. Where does that stand, and how is that going to affect California moving forward?
Well, it turned out to be one of the hottest issues of the year with professional athletes storming the Capitol in opposition. So in a nutshell, what we were finding was that, let's say, a baseball player would pitch one inning in California but play his entire career somewhere else. They would file for workers' comp in California. The same was happening in the NFL, the NBA. Athletes with very little ties to the state were filing for workers' comp here, in addition to filing for workers' comp in their home state. Now, why should Californians care about that? Well, many of the insurance carriers that were supposed to pay for these claims were going bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, that means the California Insurance Guarantee Association, the California business owners, end up picking up the tab for all of that. And so it was a huge issue, and it turned out to be a huge cost for California businesses. And so now that the governor signed it into law, we didn't say that they couldn't file for workers' comp in California, but we set some very clear parameters as to who qualifies and who doesn't, which didn't exist in the past. So I feel like the compromise that we reached moving forward is a very good compromise, and it allows for a framework and for some benchmarks to be met before professional athletes could file for workers' comp in California, preserving our system, but also maintaining access when it's required.
And one last question. Assembly Bill 219, which is now law, the governor signed it. It's about cancer treatment and medication. Very briefly, tell us what that's about and why you supported it.
Very near and dear to my heart. I lost my mother to cancer a year and a half ago. Essentially, what we did with AB 219 is said that we are putting a $200 cap on the cost of oral chemotherapy. We had Bren Flowers, a cancer patient who testified from Fresno for us. She was spending $3,000 to $4,000 a month on her oral chemotherapy. AB 219 will ensure that she and other patients will spend no more than $200 a month on their medication.
So the insurance companies make up the difference. How does that work?
The cost is spread among everybody in their premiums. Okay. And the analysis shows that it's less than a penny per person.
Again, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea joining us today on Valley Edition, talking water, prisons, and all sorts of things with the end of the legislative session. Assemblymember Perea, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. We'll be right back in just a moment and hear a special report on hunger in the Valley from the California Report's Sasha Coca. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's harvest time in the San Joaquin Valley, and farm workers are out shaking almond trees and picking grapes. The Valley is one of the most productive farm regions in the world, yet the people who work and live near these farms often struggle to feed their families fresh and healthy food. It's one of the great paradoxes of life in the San Joaquin Valley. In the first part of a series called Hunger in the Valley of Plenty, the California Report Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca starts by introducing us to a farm worker family who can't afford to buy the produce that grows all around them.
Mommy! Yes!
To get to Jessica Ortiz's kitchen, you have to step over some rotting floorboards in the crowded living room, peel back a curtain, and wait for your eyes to adjust to the darkness. She's got the shades drawn to keep out the heat and bugs, but you can see her face by the dim bulb that lights up when she cracks open the refrigerator door.
This is what our refrigerator looks like at the end of the month. It's still a few days till we get our food stamps.
Ortiz's husband, Oscar, is out working in the almond orchards, and she's trying to figure out what to feed her five kids tonight. She's got a few eggs, some potatoes, and half a bag of breakfast cereal.
We don't have milk, and their bologna and ham, and all their sandwich stuff. Bread, we don't have. Our freezer is totally empty.
The Ortiz family lives in Raisin City, a speck on the map in Fresno County. It's a town of about 400, surrounded by vineyards. Farm workers take a break from work at the tiny local park. Many field workers here are from Mexico, but others, like the Ortizes, were born and raised in California.
See if Jojo wants some chips. Come on, guys. Joshua, do you want some juice?
Oscar is deaf. Jessica dropped out her senior year of high school after getting pregnant with their first child. Their job prospects might be better in a bigger city, but here the only work is seasonal, often part-time field work. Oscar averages $170 a week.
He's out there picking for, you know, almost the whole world. And, I mean, he only brings, like, so much money home to feed his own family. We have many, many field workers that do that. They're providing for everybody else's family and barely bring enough home to take care of their own.
The Ortiz family gets by with food stamps and cash aid from the government. But money goes quickly at the local mini-mart, one of the only places to shop in Raisin City.
Ask him how much the bread is. $3.49? Are you out of your mind?
And the produce? Wilting cilantro and cabbage, overripe bananas. Junk food is a cheaper choice.
Go get an ice cream. You want an ice cream?
Jessica buys herself some beef jerky, then scrutinizes her receipt as she leaves the store.
I got a loaf of bread, a gallon of juice, three ice creams, and it was like $14, $13, $15. So that's pretty much, could have got it cheaper in Fresno.
But getting to big grocery stores in Fresno isn't easy. The 25-mile trip turns into an all-day task since the Ortizes don't have a car and the bus only comes once a day.
We could tell people, yes, you're supposed to eat so many servings of fruits and vegetables.
That's Sara Ramirez, the former epidemiologist for neighboring Tulare County.
It's easy to say and not take into account the environment. The fact that in these communities, sometimes soft drinks are more affordable than water.
This region ranks among the highest in the nation when it comes to food insecurity or families not knowing where their next meal is coming from. But Ramirez says the Central Valley also struggles with an epidemic of obesity and diabetes.
Maybe you're having to make the choice of even buying less quality food just to fill up on calories.
In a region where one in four households has a hard time putting food on the table, food banks have become a primary source of nutrition. Andy Souza heads Fresno's Community Food Bank, which serves towns like Raisin City.
A high percentage of we serve are the actual working poor and folks that are trying desperately just to make ends meet. Unfortunately, when you have to give between a car payment or a house payment or utilities in food, you can skip a meal.
Hundreds of residents line up each month for Raisin City's food giveaway, arriving hours in advance to secure a place in line. Jessica Ortiz is here, too.
I always thought that, you know, okay, well, things are getting hard for myself. But no, I've seen other people that, you know, have the same struggles.
Ortiz is not just here to pick up a box of food. She also volunteers on the food line.
I know that I'm doing something to help the community I live in. That one bag of whatever you're giving at that day, you know, puts a smile on either their child or their face. It makes you feel even better.
For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Raisin City.
73, 74.
You're listening to Valley Edition. As state and local governments struggle to provide services in an area of reduced resources, many are turning to the issue of privatization. While the city of Fresno's effort to sell off the rights for residential solid waste collection failed this year at the ballot box, the city has already privatized its commercial solid waste division. And in Sacramento, Governor Jerry Brown is turning to private prisons as one way to deal with the prison overcrowding problem. Supporters say it's about efficiency and saving money. But in this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Ida Jones, professor of business law at Fresno State, says there are also hidden costs to privatization.
Privatization is the buzzword that represents tax revenue-strapped governments transferring services to the private sector to save money. But does it? Supporters of privatization argue that there will be cost savings through eliminating government bureaucracy and reducing taxes. No longer will taxpayers have to pay for guaranteed jobs, lazy workers, red tape, and inflexibility that come with government services. Supporters also argue that private enterprise can deliver government services more efficiently and cheaper, providing increased tax revenue and more services for fewer dollars. How well has that worked? Let's take one example. For-profit prisons have become a multi-billion dollar industry that spends millions lobbying for criminal law reform. According to an article in the New York Times, the U.S., which has 5% of the world's population, has nearly 25% of its prisoners. The U.S. incarcerates more people for more crimes and for longer than any other industrialized nation. There are a variety of reasons for that, but the trend toward privatizing prisons parallels the significant increase in the numbers of prisoners, the numbers of crimes that result in prison sentences, and increased prison terms. The main argument for privatizing prisons is that they save money. However, the cost savings results are decidedly mixed. And there are reports that those savings come at the expense of low employee wages and terrible prison conditions. After all, in order to make a profit incarcerating people, one must reduce costs somewhere. Private for-profit prisons have no incentive to reduce recidivism or rehabilitate prisoners. After all, the more prisoners, the more money, and thus more profit. This example illustrates the problem with the current focus on privatization, that providing government services is reduced to a balance sheet without looking at society's long-term needs. First, government jobs were the only jobs that provided job security and good benefits. And for many years, these were the only jobs minorities could find where hiring was based on merit. Typically, that meant that although the job may not pay as much as one in the private sector, the trade-off of job security and benefits made it worthwhile for individuals and for society. And after all, doesn't society benefit in the long run when people are employed and have job security? Second, people who have job security are willing to, and did, purchase houses, cars, and other consumer products that generated income and jobs for others in society. They spent more of their income rather than saving it, and that spending helped to fuel the economy. Finally, the U.S. is a country that prides itself on encouraging independence and self-reliance. What happens to those values when you move large numbers of people to jobs where there is no job security? Well, it creates an atmosphere where people no longer feel that same independence. These are consequences that cannot be directly measured through a balance sheet. Privatization should not be considered the panacea that will cure government's economic woes. There is more to delivery of government services than the financial cost. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week, the PBS Frontline program featured a documentary about the concussion problem in the National Football League and that professional sports league's efforts or lack thereof at addressing the issue. The issue of football concussions, though, goes beyond just the pros, and it's an issue throughout the country, including here in the San Joaquin Valley. Joining us now in our studio, we have two guests with personal experience in this issue. We have Steve Johnson, who's a local high school teacher and a former football player. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Brenna Hughes, who is the team leader. She is an acute care speech-language pathologist at Community Regional Medical Center, and she was also the person who helped organize a recent event that took place at UCSF Fresno, the first Valley Concussion Symposium. Brenna, welcome.
Thank you.
How much of a problem is this in the Valley, and how much do you see this dealing with young men and and folks who have to deal with the concussion problem from organized sports?
It's a big issue. You know, we see the frustration amongst medical professionals, from physicians all the way to athletic trainers and speech pathologists. Personally, my experience at a level one trauma center, we evaluate a lot of patients with traumatic brain injury, including the mild ones. And a lot of times in doing the thorough history with these patients, we see that this brain injury indeed is not their first oftentimes. And pre-existing concussions or mild traumatic brain injury may have led to the impulsive behavior that we see with the acute traumatic brain injuries as well.
Yes, Steve, I want to turn to you because you have some personal experience in a different way with this issue as a former football player who's dealt with these things. Tell us about your story.
Well, going back to when I was actually a kid, I was always very active, played a lot of sports as well as unorganized sports. Over the course of my life, I've had somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 concussions. Probably about five of those came from organized football. I actually had two concussions in the same game with only one play in between them. Coach actually sent me back in knowing that I was not right. And on the next play, I knocked myself out. Most of the concussions over my life were not actually diagnosed by a professional because I didn't take myself to get treated. But they were all ones that I've learned now with the explanations I've learned. And looking back, I had some altered state of some sort following them or memory issues. Following my last concussion, which was about 4 years ago, I started having seizures. And over about a six-month period of time, I just got progressively worse with the seizures and excessive medications. Ended up in the hospital for about a month. Had lost my ability to walk without a walker, couldn't talk very well, slurred all my words, missed 6 months from work, had to learn how to walk again, had to go through speech therapy, had to go through a lot of therapy just to kind of try and learn how to function in life. I still struggle every day. Life has become very hard. Even though I function, I'm able to work. Life is just a lot harder than it used to be.
There's a lot of folklore with football, and this it's supposedly a quote unquote manly sport, and in the traditional, you know, we see in the movies and things and old films, you know, the player gets hit and the coach says, "Oh, get back out there," and you got your bell rung or something like that, and tough it up and you know, go out there and play. Was there ever an awareness of the risks that you put yourself in as a player back when you were playing?
No. In fact, getting the bell rung was almost like a badge of honor. If you were considered a hard hitter, which I was, getting your bell rung was considered to be a normal part of the game. I was taught to lead with my head, not the top of my head, but to lead with my face mask. And if I hit somebody hard enough that I rung my own bell, I was actually proud of that. I can remember coming off to the sideline that one where I had two in the same game, and I had to miss a play because if you go down and they stop the play, you're required to miss one play. During that play, the coach basically came up to me, held his hand in front of my face, said, "How many fingers do I got up?" I can remember saying, "I guess four." And he spun me around, slapped me on the butt, said, "Good enough, go hit somebody." And on the very next play, I hit somebody and knocked myself out. It was not something I was aware was dangerous. I didn't know there were ongoing consequences for it. I didn't know any of the symptoms to look for afterwards. It was just nothing really known. It was just a normal accepted part, like as a teenager riding a skateboard without a helmet and having your head bounce on the sidewalk was no big deal. Me and my friends had that happen all the time.
So obviously this is an issue that goes beyond football, but there's a lot of attention on this right now, and football is certainly a sport that has this problem in a unique way. When you hear Steve talk about that story and the way that his coaches dealt with him and his knowledge as a student athlete of the consequences, well, there's been a lot of media attention on this over the past 5 years. Has it changed are we still at that point where he describes, or has it improved in any way? Where are we as far as awareness, both with players and adults and coaches?
Well, first of all, when I hear Steve's story, it makes me cringe, absolutely. And this is not the first time I'm hearing it, but it still makes me cringe. We are, I think, battling that culture of football and hard hitting and all of that. But I do think it's improving. I think we are starting to look at that player as, you know, you had a concussion. You're not a wimp for not going back in. We're starting to look at it as, hey, is he okay? And we're starting to look at what are the services and the assessment that they need. One of the things that makes me cringe when hearing, you know, Steve had this very obvious initial concussion and he was sent back in, is when we're talking about sports-related concussion, we're talking about prevention of further injury, a secondary injury of a very vulnerable brain. And so when he had that initial concussion, that assessment should have taken place and deemed that he had a concussion. And now it's state law that when you're suspected of having a concussion, you be removed from play and you don't return until you're cleared by a licensed healthcare professional trained in concussion management. And so it's not a one-step thing. You don't just go right back into the game the next day, the next play. It is a stepwise process to get to that point. And that can take weeks. It can take, you know, months. It can take years for some players, especially if they've had repetitive injuries.
And that issue of repetitive injuries is also something that's been brought up in some of the media accounts of this, saying it's not just always the big hit that is the problem. It's all of those little small hits added up. Is that borne out by your experience as well, Brenna?
Absolutely. When you think of the anatomy of your brain, it's very soft tissue. It's like Jell-O, and it's basically floating on water, what we call cerebral spinal fluid. And it's inside a shell, your hard skull with ridges on the inside. And so it's basically like an egg. And when you think of that egg going full speed and just stopping suddenly, what happens to that yolk inside the egg? It flies forward. There's shearing and tearing of that outer layer of the brain tissue that happens. And we know that there's shearing and tearing and swelling that occurs. And the brain goes through this cascade of trying to repair itself, and that takes time. You know, we know this happens because of what we call post-concussive symptoms. Those are an indication it's happened. Patients have headache, nausea, sometimes vomiting. They have sensitivity to light or noise. They can't pay attention. They can't concentrate. They can't remember things. There's a number of symptoms that continue on, and that's an indication really that the brain is still healing itself. And so that's one of the clinical indicators that would tell us, okay, this athlete is definitely not ready to go back into a game. Their brain is still healing.
And I want to point out one thing. Yeah. I actually experience everything Brenna just brought up on a daily basis. I still have all of those symptoms. One of the things I was taught and are told in the beginning was that I was going to get back pretty much whatever functionality I was going to get within about 18 months. And I've been continuing to get better for 3 or 4 years now. And in our support group that I go to, I see people that have been injured 15, even 20 years ago, still getting better on a daily basis. So I just wanted to bring that up, that even though I'm still experiencing all of those things, I still have a lot of hope that my brain's going to continue to heal enough that I won't. And just anybody that's listening, when they tell you 18 months, it's a lie. Don't believe them. You're going to keep getting better if you keep working.
You mentioned the support group. Do you connect with fellow athletes, other folks who've had these sorts of issues, or fellow football players? I mean, is this something that is sort of common to the fraternity of?
No, most of the people in the support group got their injuries through other ways. I think that's kind of why Brenna kind of picked me out, because I am one of those people that had athletic concussions. Quite honestly, I believe most guys like me are not going and seeking help. They are still stuck in that thing that if you're a tough guy, you don't ask for help. You don't say you're having real issues. I did not ask for help until it got to the point where I could not function. And I believe that there are a lot of guys out there probably like me that are suffering very silently.
Brenda, if there's one thing that could be done moving forward to try to improve the way we deal with these, either whether it's preventing them or dealing with the consequences or raising awareness, what do you think we can do? What is the next step, the low-hanging fruit that we could approach and try to prevent future stories like Steve's from happening again?
Well, I mean, education, I think, is always going to be the best start. Education to parents, especially. You know, I would definitely want parents to know they're taking a calculated risk by allowing their children to play football or play a high-impact sport. It doesn't even have to be football, like soccer or cheerleading even. And knowing that, you know, if they are going to partake in a sport like that, that they are definitely educated and aware of the risks. I mean, you know, personally, I would like to see, you know, they're start looking at the age we allow athletes to play these high impact sports. We know children are especially more vulnerable because of their less developed neck muscles. They can't hold their head up, especially with that heavy equipment. They have lower cerebral blood volume. And they have less myelin, basically protection on the outer layer of the brain. And so we know that children are especially vulnerable. But I would want the parents of these children to be very educated and be able to make that educated decision when they allow their child to play football and know the signs or the symptoms if and when they suspect a concussion, because they're the ones that truly know their child the best.
Steve, I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I don't know if you have kids or not.
I do. I actually have 19 and 15-year-old sons, neither of which are athletes. They're both real intellectual and artistic types. I never pushed them one way or the other with sports, but they're not athletic themselves.
What if they were and they had wanted to play football? Knowing what you know now, what would your thought process have been in terms of what would you tell them?
I wouldn't have said no, but I would have spent a long, long time trying to find an alternative that they were willing to accept. If I knew now what I know now and was 13 again, would I put on a football uniform? No, I wouldn't. Would I have put it on at the time with you trying to explain to me the consequences? Probably yes. And I think that's part of what Brenda's talking about with educating parents. Being a teacher myself, our young people do not necessarily make the best decisions when it comes to their own best well-being. And I probably wouldn't have, but being a grown man now, looking back, would I say, yeah, let's go through it all again? No, I wouldn't.
And Brenna, for you, I don't know if you have kids or not, but if the issue came up about playing a high-impact sport, whether it was football or soccer, you take the ball off the head, or you even mentioned cheerleading. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. There are definitely some injuries that can be related there. Mm-hmm. What would your response be if one of your kids wanted to do something like that?
Well, I only have a 2.5-year-old daughter, so I'm not having to deal.
Hopefully we'll know more about these things before then.
Yeah. I'm not having to deal with that yet, but I, you know, like Steve said, I would try to deter her, definitely. But I would be very closely monitoring these things, and I wouldn't be relying on the coach or even, you know, a potential physician to tell me. I would be, you know, I know my daughter the best, right. and I know if she's exhibiting, you know, these types of symptoms. I know if she's struggling or more emotional, and I would be closely watching that, absolutely.
Again, our guests today have been Brenna Hughes. She organized the first concussion symposium in the Central Valley just a few weeks ago. She is an acute care speech-language pathologist at Community Regional Medical Center. And also Steve Johnson. He's a high school teacher and a former football player who's dealing with the effects of concussions, athletic-related and otherwise. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and for Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.